Hi, it's Dave. Today I'm joined by Chris Camillo from the YouTube channel Dumb Money. Chris started out with $20,000 in 2007, and now he's grown his account to over $25 million. He's developed his own investing and trading strategy he calls Social Arb Investing. I want to welcome you on the show, Chris.
Hey, awesome. Great to be here.
Awesome. Can't wait. Yeah, I've been excited for this interview. A bunch of my viewers have asked me over the months to get you on the show. I want to get into kind of, your whole social arbitrage investing, how you're using it, the pros and cons, the bigger picture. What's your motivation, in investing after a certain point? But before all of that, I want to go and start with your portfolio performance, because it's been remarkable since 2007. To clarify, so you started with $20,000. So where did this kind of initial money come from? And then it seems like you grew it to, I was watching the 2010 interview, and you're saying your account had grown to $2 million by then. And now it's, over 25. And I think you said that you've pulled a bunch of money too. So I think over $40 million in profits, probably for taxes and other investments. But yeah, what's the bigger picture here? Like, 2007, can you take us back to kind of, $20,000? Did you stick it into a brokerage account? Like, how did you find your first investments back then?
I was just an ordinary guy with an ordinary job. I worked for a market research firm. I was in business development. But really all aspects of my life were, it was a pretty big company at the time. I was making pretty good money, but never enough. Right, to support your life goals. And you're always like, how do I get to where I want to be? Could I get there through my job? Theoretically, yes. But for most of us, most of our income earning ability in life is pretty much capped. I mean, not hard capped, but like, it's not like we can go from making $150,000 a year to $1 million a year. That's just not reality. And quite honestly, that was the kind of money that I wanted to make. Not necessarily for my own lifestyle, but to achieve some of my life goals, which are, we could talk about later, which are kind of like super philanthropic, and I didn't want to work my whole life for somebody else. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that wasn't going to happen at my job. As an early kid, like I used to arb garage sales. So I was a nutty kid. I would ride my bike and take buses, like public transportation, all around Dallas, Fort Worth, North Texas, where I lived. In middle school and high school, looking at estate sales and garage sales for merchandise that was mispriced. Usually it was like train sets or old fans or like watches, usually male oriented items, because most of those sales were priced by females. So like I was doing that every Thursday, Friday and Saturday at like 6 a.m. And I would always start my morning with a lemon flavored Snapple iced tea. One morning I realized the 7-Eleven had a very small inventory of that compared to what they used to have, like shelf space, because all these competitors were coming in. I ended up shorting Snapple stock through my older brother, who's a stockbroker. So I kind of had some wisdom into like investing, and he taught me how to do that. And I just gave him a couple $100. And sure enough, it was the worst quarter in Snapple's history because of the competition, inventory building up, blah, blah, blah. Like everything I had seen in my local 7-Eleven played out. And I tripled my money in put options, and my mind was blown because I was like, how did I just do this as a 13-year-old, right? Or 14-year-old. And then I honestly like tried every investment style after that, and nothing really worked for me. I didn't realize that I was doing the one thing that would ultimately work later on in my life. Left investing for a long time to have fun and go to college and do other things. And here I was in my mid-20s now trying to figure out how to make money again. And I went back to the 13-year-old me, and I started doing this thing that I now called basically information arbitrage, or modern day, it's like social arbitrage. But I started doing that without calling it anything. And before you knew it, in like 3 years, I turned 20,000 to 2 million, 20,000 to 2 million, mm-hmm. which was crazy because it was like, that was like 100 times my money. I quit my job. I think the highest ranked person on a thing called Covestor, which was the very first portfolio tracking service mm-hmm. at the time in like the mid 2000s. They audit your accounts, and I got a bunch of publicity. I got offered a book deal. I wrote a book back in 2010 called Laughing at Wall Street. And the whole time in my head, I was like, is this just an anomaly? Am I going to lose all my money? If you're like, is this going to, there's no way I can continue these returns for like 3 more years. I just want to do it for like 3 more years. And in the back of my head, I was like, could you imagine if I did this for a full 10 years? I always had that in my mind. I was like, if I could do this for 10 years, I'll believe that what I'm doing is real. But until I could do it for that long, I'm always going to think like the Nassim Taleb philosophy of you're just an outlier. You got lucky. You know, maybe all this stuff in my head about my methodology of purely trading information, not looking at stock price, not looking at management teams, not looking at fundamentals, not looking at technicals, literally only trying to early trade one piece of information on a company. Like, maybe I was just insane and that wasn't really working. I was just getting lucky as an outlier in life. But at some point I hit 10 years and it was like, oh my gosh, it just kept going and going. And now I'm 15 years in. I want to say the most recent audit has me at roughly 80%-ish, maybe 75 to 80% annualized returns over the past 15 years. And yeah, it's about over $40 million of profits from that initial, well under $100,000 that I started with. And unfortunately, I took a lot of money out over the past 15 years. So it's like I was in Jack Schwager's Unknown Market Wizards and we were joking around. Like, he was like, if I hadn't taken this money out, like, I think we calculated it that I'd be over $100 million if I would have left all the money in and just let it compound with my same returns. But here I am with, you know, a lot less than $100 million, but I make a lot of private investments too. So I have a huge, I think 65 companies that are private that I'm invested in. So I'm constantly pulling money out of the market to invest in seed level and venture level companies across even pre-IPO companies. Like, I'm an investor in Robinhood, for example. I've been invested for many years in Robinhood that will hopefully IPO next week.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the kind of story of how it all came to light. I just started doing it and I just quit my job. Like, literally, a year after, a year and a half after doing this in my mid 20s, I was like, oh my gosh, like, I'm making more money from this than I am from my job. And I remember telling my buddy Patrick, who was in a cubicle right next to me, I said, if my account gets to $1 million, I might just quit this job. And then it got to $1 million. I was like, dude, I'm going to write a book. I got a book deal. I'm going to write that. And then I'm just going to invest full time. And I was like, is that crazy? And I'm so glad I did it. Looking back, it was scary as anything to do. So scary.
Was all of your money, has it always been in personal accounts, or did you put it into an IRA, like a Roth at all? Or how does that work?
Yeah. So I have like a tiny, well, it's not so tiny anymore. I do have like a tiny rollover IRA that I don't even actively trade that much. But yeah, it's blown up too. I never even calculate how much, if that's the same percentage, but like, it's pretty much, you know, I occasionally will do a social arb trade in it. But 95% of my money is in just a single account. And I've actually kept it in one account through the years, because I always knew that I would have this kind of like audit thing, you know, I want to get it audited. Which has been great because I've kept it in a Scottrade account. Now it's Ameritrade because they acquired Scottrade, but it's always been consistently inside of one brokerage account, which makes the auditors able to, or like Jack Schwager, easier for him to go in and audit like 15 years worth of brokerage statements.
Yeah. So I want to get into kind of the secret sauce here. I want to pull out kind of some insights and value to the point where, like, it could really be valuable for people, you know, like, and I know you've got some other interviews out there, so I'm going to link to some of them here, but I want to try to go a bit deeper than anything else out there. I really want to see, like, you know, what's at the core of kind of your angle that's giving you an edge. So I want to start out with this is when I, you know, listen to all your stuff, the first thing that comes to mind is you understand investing kind of like on a fundamental level, where you're trying to say, hey, there's something mispriced, you know, there's always opportunity, and you're looking for that kind of mispricing, you know, behavior, whether it's like this information, you call it information imbalance. Like you might know something that other people don't, therefore they will know it eventually. And, you know, the price will reflect that. Where does that come from? Like, when did you first kind of get in touch with this? Does it go back to garage sailing where you start to see, like, you know,
honestly, hey, like I crushed garage sales. Like before Gary V, I was Gary V-ing as a kid. Mm-hmm. Like I was crushing them. I was making good money. Before there was eBay, I was buying these things at garage sales and I had dealers. I had a guy named the Fan Guy. He only bought old fans. I had a watch dealer who only bought old watches. I had a buyer at different antique malls for every little type of thing. So I knew that I could buy that for $3 and sell it for $30, which none of it was like game changing money. But as a kid, it was like wild because I would spend like 10 or 15 bucks at a weekend and make 100 bucks in profit doing this stuff. So I had already an ingrained idea that there are always opportunities to arb information or knowledge because there's massive amounts of noise. So like these garage sales have thousands of things and it's really easy amongst all that noise for people to underappreciate something that they don't really understand. Now that maybe happens a little less today. In fact, I still do garage sales, by the way. So like I was at a sale a few weeks ago because I found out that they had Pokemon cards and I was literally there for 6 hours waiting for this lady to pull out the Pokemon card. She finally pulls them out and she's like on the internet typing in every single card. I'm like, oh great, I'm not gonna make any money here because like it's harder for people to misprice now than they used to. But it did take me a long time to believe that, you know, when you're off Wall Street, when you're just like a retail investor like I was, you always think there's no way they could be missing this, right? Like you have Wall Street, it's a $1 trillion institution, tens of thousands of analysts and hedge fund managers and all these people, hundreds of thousands of them around the world. How do they not see what I see? And it took me a while to realize that they don't see most things, okay? Like, because the noise is insane. Like, I'll give you the perfect example, you and everybody that like watches your channel, you know, you're one of the preeminent Tesla channels, right? If you're a big time Tesla investor and you've been a big time Tesla investor for the past 6, 7, 8 years, you're probably a social arb investor and you don't even know it. Because you were able to see something very early in Tesla. Either you were driving a Tesla, you knew someone who had a Tesla, you experienced the product, and for whatever reason, you were able to see what was right in front of your face. Wall Street can never see big changes, ever, never, ever, ever, right? Wall Street does not see big change. They don't believe it even when it's right in front of their face. So as ordinary people, we can identify change, especially when that change is connected to culture or connected to female or youth or anything that's slightly out of the comfort zone for your stereotypical mid-40s, 50s, East Coast male, financially minded Wall Street professional, okay? Those are all areas of opportunity. Culture, products, brands. Honestly, most of the world is outside of the comfort zone for Wall Street. Most things, okay? If you want to find change related to a banking institution, okay, theoretically, they're a little closer to that than us. But even in banking, they don't understand where the future is going with banking, right? Like, they don't even understand that. So, but most people don't believe that. And I don't blame them. Most regular investors like us, I didn't believe. This is all I do. And it took me like a decade of making insane returns year after year, over and over again. And I'm still doubting myself every day. I'm like, there's no way they don't see this. Until a major marker in my life was I was also I also involved in private companies, and I had a private tech company that I was involved with. I was actually the COO of. It was a startup, and I would kind of do that stuff in addition to my investing. We sold that company, and I had the ability to do anything I wanted after that sale. And I convinced my partner, Jordan, to start a social intelligence company for Wall Street, essentially doing everything that I had been doing for years, but automating it with technology. Because what I had been doing was essentially looking at Twitter, looking for keywords on Twitter that were trending, and trying to understand changes in conversational volume around granular topics that were meaningful to publicly traded companies or sectors. But it was a really difficult thing to do, just eyeballing it. So I was like, my dream as a social arb investor would be to have a software platform that would ingest the entire Twitter fire hose. Back in the day when Twitter was not just politics, right, and news flow. You remember early on in Twitter when everybody discussed everything on Twitter? Like if you bought something cool at a store, you'd go on Twitter and discuss it. So I was like, what if we could absorb that? And then what if we can come up and build an ontology of words and word combinations that would represent all of the world's products and all of the world's brands and all of the world's technologies, and every type of cultural movement would be verbalized through a combination of words. All the world's most important people and places, basically anything that had any potential to be meaningful to one or more publicly traded companies, we would curate in a list of what I call tags for that company, word combinations, products, places, brands, people, technologies, cultural movements, government regulations. And we would manually curate that list of tags for each and every publicly traded company. We would put all of those tags in an ontology that is mapped back to those companies. Then we would take this ontology of tags and we would layer it over the Twitter fire hose. And we would start counting mentions of each tag on a minute by minute, second by second basis. And we would build a history going back in time for each of those tags. So then we could start to identify changes in conversational volume year over year, quarter over quarter, like in the 2 weeks prior to every iPhone release, how many people are speaking about getting a new iPhone versus the last year and the year before that and the year before that. If there's a new trend that's popping up, we would identify it quicker than anybody else because we would have algorithms to identify the change in conversational volume around that granular topic, right? So rather than me being on my phone all night looking for stuff manually, the computers would do it for us. Like that was the dream. Mm-hmm. Wild, we actually did it. We built it. It was called Ticker Tags. And I had 45 kids in a room for months, basically reading every article about every company, looking at every earnings transcript, understand the company, extracting tags, curating them. Like, you remember the Pandora project for music? It was a Pandora project where they basically did that with songs. We did that for companies, and we ended up having, I think we launched with about 350,000 word combinations, and by the time we sold that company to Jefferies Bank, I don't know, 4 years ago, 5 years, a few years ago, we had over 1.5 million word combinations. We were one of only three partners that were formally partnered with Twitter. We were ingesting the Twitter decahose, which is a 10% randomized sample of the fire hose in real time. And we had 7 years of history. And our clients were Wall Street banks and some of the largest Wall Street hedge funds and quant funds in the world. And it was an eye-opening 4 years of my life because I had an opportunity during that time to essentially work closely with the brightest minds on Wall Street and people I really respect. But at the same time, there was this institutional thing, like this wall that prevented even the brightest funds on Wall Street from taking this amazing type of data and incorporating it into their workflow. And what I realized was even the best funds were taking many, many, many weeks to basically extract value from this data when I could do it in an hour, okay? Because they just had this very antiquated way of thinking about things. They didn't really have the right people in place to like interpret this data set. And the problem, the real problem, was that my data set was based on social data and it was contextual, meaning that it was interpretable. Because a lot of times, just the data alone doesn't tell you anything. You have to understand the context and the narrative behind the data anomaly. And that would take human interpretation. So the type of person that could do that really didn't exist at a hedge fund or quant fund. There are these a quantum mental analyst that everyone talks about, but they don't really exist or didn't 5 years ago, 6 years ago. So I was like, oh my gosh, like none of these people can do what I've been doing, even with the best tool in the world that I built. And so when I eventually sold the company and it kind of got wrapped into other institutional software for Wall Street, I walked away so empowered because I finally had gotten to see the other side of the curtain. And there was, I don't want to say that there wasn't intelligence, more intelligence than you've ever seen, but there were all kinds of issues that would prevent institutional Wall Street from doing what I do as quickly as I do it with as much conviction as I have, right? So I knew that I would be able to crush them now that I was like stepping away and I could just trade my own account full time. And so since I sold ticker tags, it's actually been the best I've ever done the last few years. And mostly because I have confidence. So I don't second guess myself. When I come across information that I think is game changing, I go all in on it. And I'm not second guessing, well, no, Citadel must know more than me. No, they don't. Right? Like, I know all these funds. I know all the banks. I know the teams. I literally spent a big part of my life for 4 years training some of the largest Wall Street analysts on this. And by the way, all amazing people, very smart, but they are consumed by more noise than you would ever imagine. And I got to see what their work days are like and like the screens and getting pulled in 100 different directions and meetings. I'm like, if that's my competition, I've already won. And if there was one thing I try to communicate to retail investors who for the first time ever, there's a lot of us now, which is super exciting, is that the market is not rigged against you. It's rigged for you. Like that's the biggest misconception. Are there certain things with order flow that are rigged against you? Yes. Okay. Of course. But those things are so stupid and nominal. It's how they basically shave money off the whole financial system, off themselves even, not just us. Like they shave it off of everyone. Yes, there are things like that that are rigged against us. But the really important things, we actually have a huge advantage over institutional Wall Street. Huge. The biggest disadvantage we have is that we don't believe it and they don't want us to believe it. Right? So we don't actually do as much as we could with our advantage because we're always afraid that they know something that we don't.
Got it. Okay. So I want to unpack some of these things here. I want to talk about this whole concept of the retail investor advantage, but hold off on this. This is going to be a good one here. But before that, this whole idea you said of Wall Street not being able to see change, right? There's lots of noise. What is it about Wall Street, let's say generalized, you think that is blinding them to certain, you know, things that are changing? Is it just speed? They're just too slow to see things that they want to see more of it proven out, for example, in earnings statements before they'll make the bet? Or is it something about the culture where they just don't want to, you know, depart from the norm? They don't want to take these extra risks? Or how do you view kind of the whole kind of, we'll call it the Wall Street disadvantage. What is the Wall Street disadvantage here?
Okay, let's start with the lifestyle, the workplace, the culture. You have to understand, and like I said, for 4 years, I lived this life with them. they get up, they get on a train, they get to the city, they're in an office building in Manhattan. There's CNBC playing in their lobby, right? They have eight screens and herd mentality. They're in trading rooms with 300 traders. They hang out together. They go to lunch together. They have beers together. It's the disgusting herd mentality that's full of just noise, just so much noise. And the noise, it's literally like living every day inside of CNBC. That's what it is. It's just BS all day long. And they're all just watching the same news flow, right? And they all have their Bloomberg terminals and they're all ingesting the same exact stuff, okay? Meanwhile, we are all over the place, right? We're all over the place. We are going to work all over the place. We're shopping everywhere. We're so engaged in the real world. We're so diverse. We're different colors. We're different ages. We're different cultures clashing in Discord groups, right? And all this stuff. And it's just like, that is, you have to have your foot deeply implanted in the real world to understand what's happening. They get their information from news flow and reports, right? So like literally it's like already like I don't know, it's synthesized for their industry, right? And it's like it's slow, but that's they're just accustomed to doing it that way. I get my like it would be, let me put it this way. If you were at a big fund, pick any of the top 10 funds, and they were like, you know, Dave, what are you doing all day? Where are you getting? And you're like, oh, I'm just on TikTok all day, and Instagram and Twitter, and they're like, oh, you following some big accounts? And you're like, no, I don't follow anything financial. You know, I don't look at anything financial. I'm just looking at like streetwear and, you know, I'm just looking at all this stuff. They would fire you. You would there can never be a situation you could be in working at a sell side bank or a buy side fund. But if you want to be on the edge of culture and innovation and consumer behavior, that's where you have to live. That's where you have to spend your time. It's just never going to make sense for it. They're just never going to do that, right? And so even when I was up there, I would lecture them. I would lecture the top hedge fund guys in the world, and they would like walk away. They'd be like, this is so cool. It makes so much sense. It makes so much sense. Everybody would agree with everything that I'm saying. And then the next day, they go back to their jobs doing the same thing they've always done. Because like, I'm not going to sit there and hold their hand every single day and be like, hey, were you on TikTok today? Like, how much time did you spend doing this? Like, they're just going to go back to their routine. Mm-hmm. So once you understand that, and again, I can talk about this all day long. You'll never believe me unless you literally like are living it.
Sure.
I mean, but that's how it is.
I mean, it's kind of like, you know, they think that they can add on this, you know, extra approach to their existing, you know, thing. But
that's what they want to do. Yeah. I'll tell you this. So at Ticker Tags, we started off thinking maybe we can just deliver the data and these multi-billion-dollar, deca-billion-dollar funds, certainly they have the resources and the money to have teams to ingest the data, to make sense of it, to come up with their own opinions, to test it, and then to trade it. No. And I won't name names, okay? But I'm talking the biggest of the biggest. 2 years into the relationship, it basically got to a point where they were like, well, you guys just need to interpret everything for us and produce research reports. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, really? But you know that if I do that, that all of you guys are going to get the same research report with our interpretation of the data at the same time. Wouldn't it be more value for you guys to get the raw data, do your own interpretation, maybe quicker than the next guy, and then you could have a proprietary kind of take on social data, right? They weren't willing to take that step. It even got down to the point where many of them said, we produced a research. I turned my shop into a research house. We were literally producing research every day based on our own data. So we had research analysts in-house doing it for them. Then they got to a point where we were producing the research. And you know what they said? They came back to us and said, this is way better. But you know what we really want? Can you put on the top of every research report if it's a buy or a sell or a strong, I'm like, oh, you got to be kidding me.
You want me
to tell you not only what we think about the data, but then on top of that, you want me to tell you whether to buy or sell a stock. You do know that my social arb research analyst, and they're great. You know that they're 22 years old, right? And they're like, they're literally like, this is all, like, you want them to make a stock recommendation. Like, it got so ridiculous. But, like, if you've been through that cycle, you would understand how confident I am in what I do.
Sure.
Because I've now seen what they want. Right?
Sure. Well, it's pretty obvious they want, you know, the research report. They want to pay, you know, a subscription and to get earlier access. Maybe they want, you know, a higher tier something. But yeah, they want it hand fed to them, you know. I mean, a lot of this stuff, I mean, you're talking about the disadvantage of Wall Street, the advantage of the retail investor being closer to culture, cultural change, consumer behavior. Peter Lynch, you know, famously talked about this in his book, One Up on Wall Street. Has his kind of influence, have you read his book? Has it influenced your thinking at all?
I read his book as a child, and it was definitely the most inspirational book. Like, it would obviously that's going to be the book that inspired me, right? So, like, great point, bring that up. The difference is that Peter Lynch, best of his time, love him, huge inspiration. Even what he did, and he would walk malls, right? Which is very similar to what I do now with hanging out on TikTok, right? He blended what I call observational investing or information arb or now social arb. He blended that with fundamental analysis. Totally makes sense, right? Totally makes sense. He was managing multi-tens of billions of dollars fund, right? The Magellan Fund. What I realized, and that was great for the time, but what I realized during the course of my investment journey is that when done correctly, nothing else matters besides the observational piece, the arbing of information, the arbing of social information. That when done correctly, it actually is to your benefit. And by the way, you know, I'm not, just to be clear, I'm definitely not a financial advisor. You know, I'm on dumbmoney.tv a few times a week talking about my investments and what I do.
Yeah.
But like, I definitely don't want people to take this as financial advice. But for me, I don't look at stock price at all. I don't look at any fundamentals, not a single one. I don't look at any technicals. And the reason why is because that will kind of skew my decisions on when it comes to the information I'm trading. All I care about is, was I able to identify some change that is relevant to that company that will either move the revenue needle or move the perception needle for that company once the rest of the world has appreciated or learned about that change. And for some odd reason, the rest of the world doesn't see it yet. I might be an hour early, a day early, a week early, a year early, but there's always some reason, some bias, or some access to the thing that I'm seeing. There's a reason why they don't see it. And I have to prove to myself that I'm seeing something needle moving, something meaningful that they haven't seen yet, or at least isn't fully saturated. Like, they haven't fully ingested this information yet, the investor base at large. And then I have to convince myself that there's nothing else happening at the company that is like more meaningful during this trade window than the thing that I'm trading. And so once I convince myself of those things, nothing else really matters. Now, you could make a case that the stock price theoretically might help you determine if other people have factored in this thing, but really not so much. because the stock price could be up or down. It's why is it up or down, right? So I don't really care if the stock is up or down. Like if the stock price, if you're like, Chris, why are you investing in this company? The stock price is up 100% in the last 3 months. Obviously, everybody knows about what you know about. But if it's up 100% because of this other thing, and the thing that I'm trading is totally separate, that once they realize this, it can go up another 20%, 50%, who knows, then it's irrelevant to me that the stock is up 100% or down 50%. So I really try to stay true. I call it pure social arb trading. And honestly, I understand that it's not right for many people. Most people, and we have like, I have like 47,000 people in this, in our free Discord. But most of them are not pure social arb traders. They take what I do and they kind of apply it. They also kind of do some fundamental work. Some of them do some technical work, and that's great. Like everybody does their own thing. But for me, I will always be a pure social arb trader. And I know for most people, it's impossible to close your eyes to everything else. And honestly, it's really hard for me to do too. Mm-hmm. But I would love, if I had a trading screen that would just remove stock price, that would be my dream. I can't avoid the stock price. I'm not that strong of a person to like not look at it when it's right there, but that would be the ideal setup. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there are obviously probably pros and cons, you know, to going solely off of, let's say, this information you have, not looking at the stock price. Would you say volatility? Let's say, for example, the market crashes. Let's say over the next 6 months, the entire market goes down 20-30%. Would you say that that is a like a risk factor for in your trading kind of paradigm, where you know you could have the right trade, but the whole macro environment takes down the stock price, so you lose out on the trade? Like how do you think about volatility in the equation here?
Great question. To answer the first part of it, yes. I like to say that the ideal environment for pure social arb trading is a completely flat, non-volatile market. My dream market is a market that, okay, maybe it goes up a few percent a year, whatever, fine, but essentially no volatility. The only thing that moves any company is information specific to that company. That is my dream. Right. So anything that is not that starts to get ugly. OK, mm-hmm. When we have a volatile market that's moving, it's super risky for me. Over the years, I at some points in my past, I've tried to mitigate that risk. So if I was, you know, if all of my trades happened to be long trades at that time, social arb long trades, I would tend to like, you know, purchase, you know, mitigating risk options on similar stocks across the sector, right? To kind of hedge, almost like a long short type of thing. But I've realized over the years that while there will be volatility hits that will completely throw my strategy off from time to time, I'm better off just ignoring them and taking the hits. I mean, it's just something that I've learned. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't occasionally look at the market, and when I feel that there's massive volatility, I will pull back. And I did that a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. I started to pull back on a lot of, I was 95% levered for the past 6 months. And because of variant D, I have essentially pulled back to like a 25% levering on my account, because I'm concerned about the volatility in the market. So yes, it's a huge part of the risk profile of being a social arb trader, because you don't really consider that stuff, and you have to be prepared for that stuff to nip you in the butt every once in a while. It happens.
So, I mean, okay, let's go to this whole Delta variant here and let's say pulling back some exposure and risk. How do you keep track of that stuff? I mean, I was reading one or watching one interview, you're saying you don't consume a lot of financial news, right? Traditional news. No. So how do you keep in touch with the overall market, the macro condition, you know, where things are headed in order to, let's say, hedge your position or to understand when to go super long or, you know, just kind of long on certain positions?
I have since the summer started, and I have Sirius satellite radio in my car, so I get like CNBC if I want it in my car. I have consumed less than 15 minutes of financial media since the start of the summer. I'm really proud of that. So
like total?
I haven't turned on any TV new. Like, it's all been kind of Sirius satellite for a few minutes here and there. But so yes, great question. So when I feel like there are things in the mainstream news, not necessarily financial news, that could be important, like variant D, I do then analysis just on them. So for me, variant D is a social arb thing. Okay. So like, I'm actually trading that. It's a difficult one to trade because like, it's not about what you think. It's about what the rest of the world thinks. Right. So it's like, you have to kind of understand what other people think. So I'm trading it to the best of my ability. I think there will become a point in time when the risk comes down and we kind of start to level off. We've already leveled off in the UK. So right now I'm trying to determine the extent that US investors are factoring in the fact that it will get worse over the next 3 to 5 weeks before it flattens out and starts to get better. It's, you know, it's a big game, right? And like, honestly, I try not to too overly involve myself. I don't want to overthink it. For now, I'm in a bit of a risk off place where I'm not overly leveraged. I still have most of my social arb trades. What I told my community at dumbmoney.tv is that I'm going to do my trades closer to the anticipated point of information parity. So every time when I make a trade, I make it because there's this perceived information imbalance. And at some point in time, that information I'm trading, if I'm right, the rest of the world will learn about it. Sometimes, more often than not, it could be part of an earnings announcement. So what I'll do is now, because of this volatile market and D variant, I don't really know what's going to happen day to day. If I have a social arb trade like I did this week on Crocs, I had a base position in Crocs. I knew it wasn't as high as I wanted it to be. I wanted double that position going into earnings. Normally, I will make an assumption that, okay, I'm going to go down, I'm going to go in 3-4 weeks before earnings. Because what happens a lot, and this is very important for people to understand, the one advantage that Wall Street does have over us is that they have the money and the resources to consume massive amounts of transactional data. Transactional data is credit card receipt data, right? And they're pulling this from all kinds of sources. They're synthesizing it. They're cleansing the data. They're interpreting the data. So before a company reports earnings, a company that has this type of transactional data, about a week to 3 weeks before earnings, the institutional hedge fund community and even sell side banks would have had transactional data. And that's stuff that we don't really see. It's not generally, sometimes it's reported to retail investors, but always days later to a week later after they get it. So they are getting that data and they're trading it before we see it. Okay. So fortunately, I'm trading social data, which front runs the transactional data, right? Not as exact, but it's interpretable, but I do a good job interpreting it. So I like to make my trades well in advance of earnings because I don't know when Wall Street's going to figure out what I figured out because of the transactional data they have access to. And then I don't have to even hold it till earnings. So the stock moves before earnings. Because of the environment we're in, I'm trying not to make trades until right before earnings. So I basically went into Crocs the day before earnings and essentially doubled down on my position. And I'm glad I did. It was one hell of an earnings report, right? But normally I would have done that a couple weeks ago, three weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how, that's kind of one way that I'm in a volatile environment, I'm trying to mitigate my risk on a social arb trade is to shorten my trade window. So yeah, something could have happened yesterday, but it's like one day. Like it's sure. Not 2 or 3 weeks of time.
What's the typical holding period for your trades and positions?
I always say the holding period could be hours to years, but it's usually weeks. Weeks and sometimes months. Okay. So like hours to years, but more often weeks to months. Mm-hmm. And that's because the information ARB window from information imbalance to information parity is never an exact science, meaning it's never like, you know, nobody knows about this and now everybody knows about this. It's usually like some people know about it, but most don't. Now kind of like a lot of people know about it, but there's still more room, right, for more people to fully appreciate it and to gain confidence that what we think is true really is true. You know, it's all about conviction. So it could last. And a lot of times companies will even come out with earnings and they'll point to that thing that you wanted them to point to, but they'll kind of like only go in half cocked, you know, like they won't fully come out and say how big of a deal it is. So you're like, okay, so they didn't really fully admit it, but I know that it's a bigger deal. They know it is, but they're not going to admit it. You know, they're sandbagging on that one piece of their business, and I'm going to like still stay in the trade or partially stay in the trade till it really comes out later on.
Mm-hmm. Do you have some type of like minimum percent threshold where you're like, hey, this trade should result in a 20% gain, a 50% gain or something? Or are you just, you know, blind to that?
Completely blind. Because you just don't know. I mean, listen, I could guess, and I've been doing this a long time, so I'm pretty good at guessing, but it doesn't even really matter to me. So, once that information comes to light, you know, especially in today's environment, sometimes people totally overreact to things, right? And a stock goes way further than I ever would have imagined. Sometimes it doesn't have the impact I anticipate. So I try not to overly think about that. My methodology to stay true to it, once we hit information parity, I'm out. So what I will often do, Crocs is a good example. So we hit information parity kinda for this earnings period. Mm-hmm. I still think there's multiple social ARB stories happening with Crocs. There's the quarter to quarter where Wall Street's like, oh, they did it again. I'm like, yeah, they did it again. I mean, obviously, I was watching the data, watching the social. I'm doing store checks. I knew they would do it again. But Wall Street still doesn't fully, they're always thinking, well, let's see if they can do it again. It's Crocs. It's like rubber shoes. They never really believe in the long-term story. So like I kind of have this like long-standing social ARB position in Crocs. And then like every quarter that I'm able to validate that the company killed it more than the company projected or the Wall Street projecting, I'll like double or triple down into earnings, right? Or maybe I'll pull back into earnings. So, you know, there's a lot of things going on. It's not like always an exact science, but I never really estimate how much a stock's going to go up or down. And related to that question, and you might already have this question for me, but I'll just attack it. The way that I think about executing like these trades, sometimes they're options, obviously. I generally these days try to keep my options like at the money or in the money. I don't really ever do out of the money options, especially since we've had this retail investor movement that kicked off last year. Premiums are through the roof on out of the money options. So like for me, I see a lot more value these days going at the money or in the money by 2 or 3 or 5%. Than going out the money. So I'm not overly concerned if I'm going to get a 5, 10, 20%, 30% move in the stock. In any of those scenarios, I'm going to win. So I don't overthink it.
Got it. What's your kind of breakdown of when you decide to just go stock versus, let's say, in the money or at the money calls for a play?
Well, it depends on a few things. One of them being obviously, you know, the premium, you know, what the premiums look like for that company. So if it's a company that is just trading crazy options and premiums, I'm fortunate now to be at a point in my life where I'm able to take some pretty massive risk with equity and margin. And assuming that there's a lot of liquidity in the stock, I'll just go in heavy on the stock and just lever out on the stock. If I don't like the premiums on the margin on the options, the other factor is obviously conviction level. So if I have tremendous conviction level, like tremendous conviction level, I'm more likely to overlay my equity position with an options position. More often than not, it's both. Mm-hmm. I'm trading equity first. Like my go-to move now is I'll start with equity. I'll take a look at the options, a look at my conviction level, a look at the premiums, and then also what is my conviction in the trade window, meaning like that the company is going to come out or some piece of information is going to come out by a certain date, because if not, the options don't really make sense. So if I'm buying options, I have to buy options kind of in a defined trade window or social arb trade window when I think information dissemination is likely to happen. And when I do that, when I see that, I will often go ahead and purchase options.
Got it. Sizing of your trade. Let's take three categories. Let's say you have a super duper crazy high conviction stock. What percent of your portfolio do you put in versus a medium conviction, stock versus so-so low conviction stock?
Let's talk about my like earlier on in my trading career. As crazy as this sounds, if I had a high conviction trade, I would be open to putting 50 to 100% of my portfolio in that trade. I'll give you one very early example of that that I just sticks in my mind. Do you remember when the Nintendo Wii first came out a long time ago, right? Like 13 years ago, 14 years ago, 15 years ago. I was at E3 when it was first announced, like you can first see it, and like the press was totally consumed by the new Xbox and the PlayStation that was out at the same time. Nobody cared about the like nobody was giving any attention to the Wii except actual gamers that were like, oh my God, this is a game-changing experience. And I knew that. And unfortunately, Nintendo was a foreign stock. I could only trade an ADR. I could not buy options. Super frustrating. It was at the time one of the highest conviction trades I had ever made. And what I loved about it is I was able to do daily store checks at GameStop back then and just like hanging out, talking to store managers. Wall Street was paying no attention to Nintendo back then. And so I put 100% of my portfolio in Nintendo NTDOY. I'll never forget NTDOY stock ADR stock back then. And it was like an 8 month trade. I was in the trade for about 8 months because it took 8 months for Wall Street to give any appreciation to what the hell was happening with the Wii. When they finally did, I want to say the stock was up 70%-ish. And it's just too it's just a it's a shame they didn't have options back then, because that would have really skyrocketed my portfolio if they had options. But yeah, today I won't put 100% of my I have a family, okay? Now I have kids.
Well,
I have a house.
it's also harder to recoup the losses if you were to lose everything. You know what I'm saying? Like, let's say if it's under a million, you lose everything, you could recoup it by working hard, et cetera, a certain number of years. But after 10 or 20 or 30 million, then it's like, it's going to take a while. Or,
I do have a restaurant that cash flows. I do have a couple other things that cash flow, but I do not want to have to go work for the man ever again. Okay,
Sure.
like I still wake up every day. Like sometimes I pinch myself and I'm like, God, my life is good. Like just not having to work the day job. And like sometimes you forget what it's like to work. I don't forget. I'm very aware. I have been working like 60-hour weeks most of my career for companies. Okay, right up until the time that I quit in my whenever it was late 20s or 30 early 30s. I was working since I was a late teen for companies, worked all through college full time. So like I do not want to go back to the slog of that life. And so I will not put 100% of my portfolio in any one trade, but I will put 30% of it in. I'm not afraid to put a third of my portfolio in a high conviction equities trade. I wouldn't do that with the levered options, but I would put 10% of my net worth in a levered options trade and be willing to just lose the whole thing.
If it's high, super high conviction for you.
Yeah, and I honestly, I'm prepared to lose 20% of my net worth on a trade between equity and options. I'm willing to do that. The last big trade that I took a monster hit on that was just will never leave my mind was in 2019. It was on Restaurant Brands. I lost at the time, my trading account was pretty small at the time. It was like 5.5 million or something like that, relative to what it is today. And I took a $750,000 hit, and it just crushed me because I was so high conviction on that trade. But there was one element of the trade that I was in the dark on, because they had three companies. They had Burger King, Popeyes, and Tim Hortons. And my visibility into the Tim Hortons piece was limited. And I knew that, but I was willing to go into the trade high conviction even so. It was basically a 1 in 10 year anomaly that would screw the trade, which is exactly what happened. Tim Hortons just happened to come out that with the worst quarter in the company's history, even in the same quarter that Burger King and Popeyes had the best quarters in the history of the company. I was like, what are the chances that Tim Hortons, where I have limited visibility, is going to come out with the worst? I was like, chances can't be that high, right? And it happened. It happened, right? And that was 50%, 55% of the company was Tim Hortons. So I think it was like 60%, was Tim Hortons. So I deserved the beating I got. I deserved it. And and by the way, this is late in my career. This is like 13 years in, killing it. And that set me back. I took a couple, I took 2 days off, 2 or 3 days off. I went home, I napped for a few hours. And then I was depressed for a couple of days, like severely depressed. And then I came out of it. Just, I was like, all right, I'm back. I'm back. I learned my lesson. Let's do this, man. Let's make it back. And then what's so funny is I made the highest conviction call of my life 6 months later, literally 5 months later, the highest conviction call of my life, put more of my portfolio at risk than I'd ever put ever. Coming off the worst trade of my career, and it was February of 2020. I was completely consumed by the virus in China, right? I was interpreting Chinese newspapers at night. I was all in. I wasn't sleeping. I'm like a black swan guy, so I'm always prepared for the next black swan. And so when I saw what was happening, I was like completely disillusioned. I was like, how does the world not see this? How does Wall Street not see this? Nobody is talking about this. And so I was literally, I think out of my account, which was like 6 million at the time, maybe I probably had half of it shorting the market. And I had another million or so in like put options on the market and travel stocks. And I just got killed for 2 weeks because I was 2 weeks early on the trade. And then I just kept at it. And then it was like late February and the market took that first hit. And I was like, here we go. And it's like, and then it just, it was crazy. I was like full short the market right through the crash. And it just, I think my account doubled, right? Like literally I made like $5 million in 3 weeks. And then we were off to the races. And I was like 2 days late on the recovery trade. But I had been mentally preparing for the recovery trade. I had all my recovery stock. I knew exactly what they were. I knew exactly what I was going to do. But I did also know that I would never be able to time the bottom. Like, that's not what I do. I do not time things like that, like macro markets. And so I was waiting for when the bottom seemed to clearly, I knew I was going to be late. 2 days after we hit bottom, I was like, this is it. I'm doing it. And I just took off my short positions and I went super levered long and Peloton, Shopify, like all of them, right? Bicycle stocks, outdoor stocks, like all of them. I just went super levered long and I made $30 million last year. Just basically high conviction levered trades in recovery, first shorting the market, then recovery long. And it was the year that I had been planning for since I was a kid. I didn't know what it was going to be. Yeah. But I was really preparing myself for that type of a year when the noise would be unprecedented. Because the one thing about 2020, there's never been a year with more noise. And every day I would wake up and I would be like, gosh, the entire market is consumed by this noise. And I'm on the phone with ATV dealers and boat dealers figuring out what's actually happening. I'm like, they're not seeing this. I'm like looking at ammo sales and gun sales and like camper sales. Mm-hmm. Like I was just consuming virtually no finance. Once the recovery's kind of, once we hit bottom or the weeks leading up to that, I was all in on just focusing on real things that were happening, not financial noise of interest rates and like, you know, the, are we putting too much money into the economy, like politics and all that stuff. Like, you know, I know how it works. I knew that every trader on Wall Street was focused on Trump this and like Congress this. So like they are just missing out on what is so clear. You go to your local bicycle shop, there's a line around the street. Has that ever happened in your lifetime? Ever? No, never. And you start looking at tweets. I can't buy a bicycle. I can't buy a bicycle. And by the way, it's the 25th anniversary of Schwinn. Like, and so it's just, these are things. I can't buy a boat. I can't do this. Well, I'm just, no one's doing this. They're doing this stuff instead of this stuff. Looking back, has anything ever been more clear, more vividly clear and right in front of our face than all the stuff that happened last year, yet we couldn't see in front of our face? And I always tell people, like, I don't predict the future. I just attempt to see what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because so I've done 30 episodes on my channel with one of my friends. His name is Emmett Peppers, and he actually last year made pretty much like 50 or 100 million off of just a starting base of like a million or two, right? He literally did a 50 X at least last year. But a lot of this similar kind of things where, like, you know, he timed the bottom or he the crash right before it happened and then went reversed 100%, you know, leveraged recovery as well. It's interesting because like after doing 30 episodes with him, and I've kind of had this fascination over the years with traders. So I've read all of these books on traders, the best traders in history, right? And there seems to be some type of like, I wouldn't say anomaly in the mind, but the perspective on opportunity seems different than the crowd, you know? It's a little bit counterintuitive. There's a counter thinking where it's like, everybody thinks it's going this, but to that person, it's obvious, you know, that's, you know, leading to somewhere, you know, different. So I want to go back to this idea of, you know, you start out and a lot of your kind of passion or, you know, why you're sharing is you're saying, hey, everyone can do this, right? Everyone could be a social arbitrator. They just need to see what's going on in culture, see what the consumer behavior patterns, et cetera, what's changing. But the flip side is like, wouldn't you say that there needs to be some type of a detachment, kind of this objectiveness where, let's say you're in high school and all the kids are all into peer pressure, into the cliques. They all want to be part of the clique. It doesn't matter where the clique is going. The clique could be going to hell, but they just want to be part of the clique, right? And then there's like one kid or two kids out there who look at the clique, you know, and say, oh, that's so fascinating. Why, you know, those kids would be, you know, all trying to, you know, be part of the clique at all costs, even though it's ruining their lives. And there's this outlier who kind of sees things. I guess you talk about observational investing, but this concept of kind of zooming out, kind of this ability to be, hey, here's a situation. Everybody is stuck in this situation, but I'm going to press this button, or it's not a button. It's like the mind is always running, but boom, I'm looking at it from outside and I'm able to see it more objectively than other people. Like it just seems like, you know, you have that type of ability or that skill set. I'm curious, do you really think, you know, everyone can have that? Or is there something about, let's say, your personality, your skill set, your background, or something that you think that aids that?
I know anybody can do it, but I also know that it 100% does not come naturally. Like it's the ability to objectively identify and look for change in your observational world every day is a proactive thing that you have to think about and do. So like, I am all in on it. I'm constantly thinking about it. But I have seen over the course of 15 years, people that are close to me, people that are like all in on what I do, and they have like become versions of me on their own. I've seen them do it now, and some of them do it way better than me. And they're constantly hitting me up with like, did you see this? Did you notice that? I had this, my dream was to have a massive community of social arb traders that would be more powerful than the largest bank on Wall Street and hedge fund. And like, I thought it would take me 10 years to do it. I launched Discord a year ago and it's 40,000 people. It exists. The people in my community, many of them are better at observing things than I am. Because they've like listened to me, they've retrained their mind to see their world differently. You still miss more than what you see, no matter who you are, because it's life. I was in front of that. I can't believe I missed that. Like I, the thing that haunts me is I can't believe that like I had the Michelle Obama yellow dress picture on top of People magazine on my coffee table when she wore that J. Crew dress, and I did not connect the dots to investing in J. Crew, and it was the biggest thing that ever happened to J. Crew, and that's going way, way back, right? But I mean, I'm a social arb investor. How did I miss that? Right? I saw the Jay Leno episode or whatever, like when that she was on.
Wait, do you still? I was reading something. You bought a dress at J. Crew or something.
Bought that dress.
Do you still have it? Or?
And I have it. I have it. Yeah. So like, because I've never
as a reminder, right? Yeah.
Reminder of just how difficult this is. So it's like really easy and really difficult at the same time. Anybody can do it, but you have to proactively try to rewire your brain to thinking like this. And then, of course, the hardest piece is acting on it, because like, I always tell people, like, if you want to do this, just start doing it. Retrain your brain, open up a Robinhood account, whatever, and just start like doing it and losing money, making money, learning, and just assume it's going to be 10 to 15 years before you start to get any conviction in what you're doing, because that's the real key, is like your friend and me and a handful of others that did what we did last year, like went all in, like just... We all had prepared minds way before 2020.
Sure.
We were all preparing our minds. Like, I give you an example, I hate to be dark with some of these trades, because like the pandemic trade was dark, but it is what it is, right? Like, it's gonna have a lot of these black swan events, unfortunately, are dark. I am mentally preparing for the big earthquake and have been for 15-20 years. At some point during my lifetime in the next 30 years, there's a pretty good chance that there will be a pretty significant earthquake in California, right? And like, the bottom line is you have to be mentally prepared for that. Whether, you know, you could look at it as, you know, taking advantage of a trade when that happens, or honestly, just protecting your portfolio, right? Like trading so that you don't lose all your money if that happens, right? So you have to ask yourself, like, how much have you thought about it? Like, and what are you going to do? There's a pretty good chance in the next 30 to 40 years that will happen. So if and when that happens, do you know exactly what you're going to do? Do you have the trades that you think you need to make in terms of what you need to sell in your portfolio and what you need to buy and what you need to immediately do to protect your net worth? That's what I think about, right? So if there's any type of black swan event that might be coming down the pipe, like the second I saw there was a virus out of China, we don't know for sure, but you could be darn, like, I'm going to be preparing for that every moment of every day, so that if it looks like it could happen, I know exactly what the trades I'm going to have.
Okay.
Like, it's really important to have that prepared mind.
On that note, so I was talking to my wife about kind of your story yesterday, and one of the things she commented on was, she's saying, you know, it seems like perhaps you might have a broad range of interests slash exposure to lots of things in order to synthesize all of the information to make sense of. For example, we're talking about this virus situation, right? A lot of people, you know, February 2020, like they're not exposed to what a contagion or what type of, you know, a virus could do to the markets, to, you know, whatever, you know, it can close down economies, et cetera. But it's just one example of like you're exposed, like, for example, you talk about earthquakes too, right? Yep. It's probably not just because your friend said, hey, Chris, you know, there might be a big earthquake in California. It's probably you have some deeper exposure. You, are you reading a lot of stuff? Are you like, are you just exposed to a lot of things? Like, what's going on
here? I consume an amazing amount of content, but not financial content.
Exactly.
Right? So, like, you have to be deeply rooted in the real world to be a good social orb investor. So I like to claim that I try to absorb about 4 hours a day of digital content and media across a broad spectrum of sites like TikTok, Instagram, Twitter. I am not on, like, I'm on Twitter a lot consuming. I rarely post. I consume a lot of Twitter. I don't really consume, I consume a lot of FinTwit, right? Because that's like, it's kind of fun because I'm in the industry, but like a lot of what I consume are just, I look for keywords, all these keywords I do on Twitter. And I'm on TikTok. I follow all these random accounts, and then I'll do searches for what's trending on TikTok. Mm-hmm. I like consuming a little bit of mainstream news, not business news, but mainstream news, just to see what's happening in the world. Is there a drought someplace, right? Is there a heat wave coming? Is there a hurricane brewing? Like, so the key word here is change. Like, everything I do is completely revolves around early identification of change. But that change could be literally anything. Change in consumer behavior, change in weather pattern, change in government, like a lot of my social arb trades last year were due to change in government. I was closely monitoring the election. It's something that I love doing because I have this methodology. It's worked really well. I was the very first person in the world to come out on Twitter and to say that at least my data extrapolation, I said that Biden was going to win. It was that night of, I got a lot of flack for it, but ended up being right. My firm, Ticker Tags, was the first in the world to produce a report on election day that said Trump was going to win the election based on extrapolation of social data that we had balanced in buckets. It's complex how we did it back in the day. But also we did the same thing with Brexit and got a lot of notoriety for that. So, you know, it could be government change. It could be anything. I try to identify change early and connect the dots to investable opportunities.
How do you – okay, so a precursor to actually under – like, for example – let's take politics, presidential elections, Brexit, et cetera. In order to understand what's going on, in a sense, you have to be interested in that area, you know, government or politics a bit. And in order to be interested, you kind of have to have some type of understanding, kind of foundation to understand that area. I'm curious, for example, with new areas that you need to just dive into, is there a certain way that you approach it? Do you just consume? Like, how do you... do you find the right people in that industry or that area?
Yes. All of the above. Yes. I am a self-taught person. I self-taught myself trading and finance at an early age. Like, I helped teach the options class when I was in college because no one understood options, and the teacher knew I was trading options between classes on the payphone downstairs, the business school. So he's like, you trade options, right, Chris? Can you? And I literally taught my class options. What I do, I'll give you a perfect example. Lithium and rare minerals, right? That is an area that I became really interested in this last year. But man, is it an area where you have to develop some expertise to really have an educated opinion. So I have been meeting people that have deep expertise. One of my friends is really big out of Australia. His family has a lot of land out there. They deal with a lot of this mineral stuff. So He's been educating me and teaching me. He sent me a 280-page report that I got halfway through. I'm slowly educating myself on the supply chain and lithium and how that world works so I could make good decisions and so that I could really have a deep understanding. And the more I learn, the more I realize just how uneducated at Wall Street and everybody is on how that world really, there's like a few people that really know what they're talking about, right? And honestly, there are probably people on YouTube and fans of people that are on YouTube that know way more than most professionals in the investment community on how that world works. But that's one of these like things that like it's an area that you can't really make good decisions unless you understand it. It's easier to do this with brands, products, consumer products, movies, entertainment. Like I love we did the one of my favorite trades last year was the Container Store when they had that Netflix show. Like how beautiful and pure is that? Like the top trending Netflix show is a show that is literally about the Container Store. Like how beautiful of a social arb trade is that? And Wall Street was so slow to pick up on it. Like it's just, it's crazy when you think about how many opportunities there are out there to arb social data, right? Like that. It's a little bit tougher with things like supply, like, you know, the electrification of the world. Mm-hmm. And you know, the minerals and supply chains that go into all that. But, you know, sometimes you have to educate yourself first. Sometimes you don't.
It's interesting. It seems like, you know, I mean, part of it is like, I don't know how aware you might be of it or not of it, but it seems like you have an extraordinary interest in culture and yes. how people act and behave. And it's because when I look at this stuff, here are some of the examples. It's like extremely complex, like culture and the reasons why people do certain things and how trends catch on or just it's in a way, it's very fascinating. I mean, I'm kind of like a fan of many, many fields. So I just, that's part of my advantage in investing as well is like, I have background in just studying, being exposed to almost like, I want to say everything, but I'm like a really broad kind of range of interests from like anthropology to history to music to sports to, you know, business to whatever, right? But when I listen to some of your like talking about social behavior, I'm like, wow, you really have like this, you're kind of, I want to say more passionate than a lot of anthropologists, but you have a sense of this like, this appreciation and this like fixation on wanting to understand it, but then you connect it with this investable opportunity paradigm, right? Every change is like, is it investable opportunity? But I guess it goes back to my question of like, is this really realistic for the normal folk to have this type of mentality?
It's not just realistic, but it's an advantage because you got to remember, it's where all the opportunity is because people that work in finance and Wall Street hate this stuff because it's interpretable. They like hard numbers. They love working with transactional data. They love working with hard numbers. There's very little opportunity to arb hard numbers because all of Wall Street's consumed with it. Where they're not consumed is culture and behavior because, well, it's interpretable and you don't even know if you're going to be right, you know, like, so that's where I spend all my energy because I know that that's where I can win. That's where I can develop expertise. That's where I could be the best because I have very little competition there. But honestly, and maybe less of the older generation and more of the younger generation is deeply connected in this culture because they are living through social and it's a flat world. And no matter where you live, no matter what type of a kid you are, you still have exposure to all these other types of people through TikTok and all this. And it's like, you still see things as they're happening. So it's like my kids are constantly coming to me and they're like, Dad, did you see this? My wife is like, are you aware of this? Like, cause like there, she's watching the Today Show. They've just learned how to do this through me. But as ordinary people, all you have to do is just live your life. Just learn how to observe your life while you're living it and to constantly ask questions. Is there something to that? Is there like, could that be connected to an investment? Could that be connected? I wonder who makes that product. Like by one of my favorite things, examples in the world, I talk about it all the time, is when kids were making slime at home and the key ingredient in slime was Elmer's White Glue that was a piece of Newell Brands, which is a publicly traded company. I connected all those dots to like DIY slime is hot. How do you make it? Elmer's White Glue. Who makes Elmer's White Glue? Newell Brands. They're publicly traded. Well, it's a small piece of the company, but the company barely grows. So if Elmer's Glue is going, if their sales goes up by 100%, which it pretty much did, that could, even at 2% of the company, that could increase the company's revenue by 2%. They only increased by 2% a year. So that could double their revenue this year. Well, sure enough, Newell Brands went up 18% that quarter. I had levered options and I doubled my money in Newell Brands because I was able to connect the dots from DIY slime to Elmer's Glue to this company, right? Mm-hmm. Anybody can do what I did. You know who knew about DIY slime? Every mom in America. So the only difference is those moms just need to hang out with me for an hour and listen to all this or like watch my channel, read my book or whatever. And then now it's in their brain. And the next time something like that happens, they don't need to do anything but ask the question. Mm-hmm. Is there anything here that could be connected to a publicly traded company? Do a little bit of homework on Google. It's not that hard, right? Sure. Do a little bit of homework on Google and, you know, build the connection. It's actually not that hard.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I want to push back a little bit because like, I totally get what you're saying because like on my end also, like I really feel like retail investors can have an edge that everyone can actually attain that edge. And for me, certain things just come so naturally. Like I'm able to synthesize like a lot of information very quickly and I'm able to kind of objectively see things like from a 5 or 10 year view very easily. Mm-hmm. And when I first started out, like talking with people online, like I was part of this Tesla Motors Club online forum. And I thought everybody was kind of naturally thought the way I thought, you know, or could think that way. What I found out is like that it's really the exception to think deeply, to think outside of the box, to think not with the herd. There's something that's very, very, I guess, I don't want to say counter-human, but there's like a, maybe a mimetic, you know, side of humanity that wants to just follow everyone else, right? And I think like part of me, when I listen to your stuff, is like you're saying it's easy. It's easy for you because you're not afraid to step outside of the crowd, outside of the herd, and do something that everyone doesn't understand, right? But for a lot of people, they're scared out of their living minds to do anything that's going to be different or, you know, that might be risky. And for those people, that's going to seem extremely difficult.
Have to make the decision to do it.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm not saying a ton of people can't do it. I'm just saying, you know, like the very thing that you're talking about in terms of like, let's say Wall Street has a culture. I'm saying like people have a culture too, that seems to be counter. It goes against some of the, like a lot of the things you're saying is the advantage is you're monetizing kind of like this, opportunity. Right. But it takes guts. It takes courage. It takes the ability to do something a little bit different than other people. Because the typical mom wants to just, or dad or whoever, wants to just watch a YouTube thing or an article on the top 5 stock picks for this year and choose a few in that and call it a day. That's all they want to do, right?
But not the next generation. I'm telling you, I've spent a lot of time with this next generation. And I'm telling you, they think differently than us. They are crafty. They love having side hustles. They all have a side hustle. Like all the stuff that I did when I was a kid was weird. Okay. Uh-huh. It was weird to do the garage sales thing. It was weird to be a young investor. And like now all that stuff is being mainstream because of people like me and you and all the other YouTubers and like the TikTok, you know, FinTok kids. And like, it's all coming around. In fact, like, there's a company that I'm invested in. It's a tiny little startup and they're just getting started, but it's an app called Griffin. And they basically, every time you buy something at a store, if that store is publicly traded, it will buy shares in that store. And it's like, what's really cool is that you see your account statements and you're like, look at what I bought. And it's like making the connections for you, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm working with them to go beyond just the store to like products and brands. But like, I'm so excited about the Griffin app because it will actually start a lot of those conversations for you by like, see, like you agree to, it's like a dollar. Like every time you buy something, like invest like a dollar in that thing, right? So you go to Starbucks, invest a dollar in Starbucks. But like, it's just, it gets your mind thinking about all the things you spend money on, which by the way is awesome, but like that's just the first step of it. Cause I always tell people it's not about what you do. It's not about what you like because you have biases. It's about what the whole world is catching on to, right? So you have to be really careful about your own bias because for example, I do not ride a Peloton. I have lower back issues, and it's really hard for me to be on a bicycle for any period of time. In 2020, my largest position, maybe the stock I made more money on than any other, was Peloton. I don't have a Peloton. I've never been on a Peloton, right? But I saw what was happening in the social sphere related to Peloton. I spent tremendous time on Peloton forums, right? And like, so it's not always like the Peter Lynch, this whole concept of invest in what you know. Mm-hmm. I'm really hesitant for people to take that approach because that could lead you down a really bad path. It's invest in what you see. What you observe, right? Invest in what you observe, not maybe what you are personally doing. Although sometimes that could intersect. But yeah, the Griffin app is really cool. And I'm excited for those guys. Yeah. And hopefully that will open up more people. And quite honestly, like I love talking to guys like you. And like beyond this, like I don't even like doing normal financial interviews anymore because I want to start to reach people who are young or female or who are like into fashion or into cosmetics or into like one of my largest trades was a trade in a cosmetics company because I saw a YouTube video, Jeffree Star's YouTube video about e.l.f. Cosmetics a few years ago. He had 10 million followers back then watching his YouTube videos. You know what that tells me? 10 million people could have seen what I saw. And they probably did. The only piece they missed were connecting the dots that e.l.f. Cosmetics was a publicly traded company that had never had that kind of exposure. And that was a game-changing moment for them. But all 10 million of those girls that watch Jeffree Star videos, and there's guys too, that watch Jeffree Star videos, they all saw what I saw at the same time that I saw it. You know who didn't? You know who doesn't watch Wall Street? Who doesn't watch Jeffree Star YouTube videos? You know, the 50-year-old white male on Wall Street, he's not watching Jeffree Star YouTube videos. So he's late to the game.
Yeah, awesome. Like the whole Griffin example, 2 days ago, I was thinking about, if people would have just spent 10 cents for every dollar they spent on Amazon for the past decade, right? They would be like, there would be just like totally different situation today, you know?
You know what? The young generation has heard that now so many times that it is in their head. We didn't hear about that stuff growing up, right? But they are so all over it. They want a piece of it. They want it. Yeah. They want a piece of that. They're not naive to that. They're not on the sidelines anymore.
Yeah.
And like I said, they got side hustles.
I mean, just this morning I was tweeting, you know, how I think we're just in the top of the first inning in terms of new investors coming into the game. Over the next couple of decades, we're going to have this transformation of an entire, you know, new kind of, I don't want to say society makeup, but investing is going to be very different. You're going to have, you know, it's going to be part of culture, part of society, more so than we've ever realized before. You know, before, you know, the internet, before all these apps, before media, YouTube, et cetera, investing was kind of this closed garden. You know, only certain people can get in. It's hard to start, but even when you're starting, how do you get the information, you know, to know how to invest or what to invest? But nowadays, like, it's we're getting free access to this. So this is it's going to be a huge change. And I think, like,
when I was growing up, you couldn't even get access to earnings calls. Like, you had to be a professional, an institution, to get to listen to an earnings call. How insane is that? How insane is that? Right?
Yeah, like, it's crazy.
Talk about the market being rigged against you. That was a market that was rigged against you.
I remember in junior high, we had this stock picking game or competition we did in our class. And the extent of our stock market education was look at the business section and pick five tickers that you want and track them for the next 2 months and see who wins, right? Because you couldn't get any more information. It was really hard, you know? It's like, but the world has changed radically. And I think that opens up a huge amount of opportunity. I mean, you've talked about this, you know, previously in your other just, you know, videos or channel, et cetera. But how much, like, where is this headed? Like, and what would be your kind of advice or kind of insights to the new generation or people who are just starting to get into investing? They might be skeptical. It's like, is this a real thing? They might not have a lot of guidance, and they might even have a different personality makeup than you or me either. You know, maybe they have a different approach that they'll be taking in the future. But what would you say to them to start their kind of investing journey?
Totally. Well, listen, what I would tell them is in life, you will have limited control over your income. And as a result of that, it's the income gap is a really tough problem for us to all solve. We're going to try to solve it, but it's a tough problem to solve. You have absolute control over your wealth. And likewise, solving the wealth gap in this country, in this world, is a solvable problem. And my entire life goal is to solve the wealth gap by bringing the entire world into the investor class. And I think there is no greater mission in life, at least one that I can personally contribute to. And I see all of my YouTuber friends, you're now one, that's as all part of this army. And I think our mission in life is to bring the entire world into the investor class. And if we're successful in doing that, there will be no greater good that we can do in our life, because the wealth gap will be solved. Everybody will have access. Everybody will have uncapped ability to achieve things in life that 99% of people just can't achieve today because they're limited by their income. And this is no joke. If you're young or old, you open up a brokerage account right this second. Not to is complete and utter insanity. There is no more important thing in life than being part of the investor class. It has radically changed my life. Radically. My personal thing that I'm trying to do is create a $1 billion foundation for pediatric causes. Me and my wife are really passionate about pediatric causes for a number of reasons I won't go into now, but we've had, you know, a number of incidents over our life that have touched us. I want to grow a $1 billion foundation. A lot of the trading that I do now is inside of a private foundation that I started this last year. I hope to have 8 figures in it pretty soon, and then maybe 9 figures and maybe 10 figures someday. But that's, I do aggressive trading inside that foundation. And so that's my thing, right? Mm-hmm. But that, you know, someone else's thing could be, you know, they came from a place where they can't go to college, or even if they can go to college, they only have expertise to do this type of a job that can only earn this type of money. Well, that doesn't matter, because you could earn $30,000 a year for the rest of your life and you could still find money. Everybody can find money to invest. And slowly over time, it's not just about investing. You could become a great investor. Oh, almost more important than all that is people get very intimidated by the fact that, oh, I don't have time to do this, do 5 trades a year, 10. You only need one trade in your whole life to make a difference in your life. You find one good trade. You identify one piece of change in your entire lifetime and connect the dots to an investable opportunity. And if your mind is prepared and you've been saving money for that investable opportunity and you're willing to do it the right way, and maybe you learn options so you can lever into it and all that great stuff, that one trade can change your entire life. For a lot of people, that one thing, they don't even realize they're social arb investors. That one thing was Tesla. For a lot of people that I know, they saw Tesla when the rest of the world did not see Tesla. And that one thing that they saw in Tesla changed their entire life. So don't think that you have to be a day trader or or you need to do this all the time. You open up an account, you start watching YouTube videos, you learn. Listen, I personally think that what I do, social arb trading, is for like 95% of people. And I think all the other trading is for like 5%. But that's just my opinion.
Sure.
Only because I know people, and I know most people don't want to have 5 screens. They don't want to deal with technicals. They don't want to learn about fundamentals. They're not financially minded in that way. But anybody can be a social arb trader, right? Literally anybody. Mm-hmm. So I personally have a bias towards social arb, not because I like want to tout the thing that I'm known for, but like I really feel that social arb is a gateway to feeling confident that no matter who you are, no matter what you look like, no matter how much money you have, no matter what your financial pedigree is, that it's something that anybody, literally anybody, can do. Mm-hmm. So like on, you know, I'm on dumbmoney.tv all the time just talking about what I do. I don't charge money. Like I don't have any of that stuff. Like I don't sell anything, only because I'm very fortunate in my life and yeah. I don't have to do that stuff.
Yeah.
But I love that people like you are doing what you do as well, because we need an army yeah. out there, because like, they don't teach it in school, right? That, and by the way, they're not going to teach us in school anytime soon. And the reason why they're not is because the administration in school, they're financially illiterate. People that work in government are financially illiterate. I'm not talking down about them. This is just the reality of our world. And it's really, people are like, why don't they teach us in school? Well, they don't teach it in school because teachers don't know about this. And the people that teach them don't know about this. And the government that puts laws in, they don't know about this. So how would we have it in school if nobody in this world is financially literate? Well, the next generation is going to be financially literate because of YouTube, primarily, and, you know, to a lesser extent, well, TikTok's the Wild West of financial content right now. But I will tell you, there is some really good financial content on TikTok too. And I believe if we fast forward 2 years, the good will outweigh the bad.
Oh yeah, even I'm thinking of joining TikTok, you know, for especially
I've been thinking about it for a long time, but I just can't get myself pulled.
Yeah, I mean, they're supposedly upping their video limit to 3 minutes. I think that's a big thing. I've got so much stuff. I mean, I can go on forever with you, but a few more things before we try to wrap this up. So, like we talk about. Okay, so I'm just going to ramble some thoughts. Maybe we'll go into some other topics here. But it seems like, you know, trading on bias, it seems like there could be kind of these really short kind of cycle bias trades, right? Or you can have a longer cycle. You talked about Crocs, how there's this bias against rubber shoes, right? of Crocs, and how you still hold a position. Maybe you might trade every quarter more, but then, and I, like, for example, Amazon, for 15 years there was this huge bias in Wall Street against Amazon, that it would never make money. Right. But the, the average Joe on the street was just pouring more and more of their, you know, consumer money into, you know, Amazon. And they knew that this is just huge, right? It's just growing. And there's this disconnect. Do you ever think about putting stuff into more and more of your portfolio into a long-term bias trade?
I do actually have that already. So I have like a base position in those types of trades. I have Amazon, I have Shopify, I have Peloton. I think Peloton still is one. So like Peloton is a company that I don't have a ton of confidence in, like quarter to quarter right now. Like, but I have a lot of confidence in moving out 5 years, right? So like, I'm not, you know, quarter to quarter, I will adjust or hedge my position or leverage it depending upon data that I see. But long term, I think people don't understand. Like, I always, you know what I like to do with these things? I always like to go out 100 years, and it seems so stupid. But like, all right, 100 years from now, how are we exercising? Are we going to gyms? No, we're not going to gym. I mean, maybe there might be some form of a gym in 100 years. I'm sure there will be. But 100 years from now, you could be darn well sure that digital connected fitness that's connected on a very personal level, right, through sensors and digital and virtual reality and all that stuff, like, you know that's where we're headed. Like, it's almost undebatable, right? So if you know that is where we're headed 100 years, assuming that we're still alive in 100 years, then Peloton in my head, it's almost like a guarantee. Like they're going to be, there's no doubt in my mind that if Peloton doesn't screw up massively, that they are beautifully positioned even 30 years down the road. That's more realistic to look at. They're beautifully positioned to be at least one of two big leaders 30 years from now, 25, 30, when everything is connected, everything's digital, everything is VR. So it's like people have a hard time thinking about that. But like, that's how Bezos' mind work at Amazon. And that's how Peloton thinks as well.
And I mean, what percent of your conviction on Peloton do you think is derived from your observations in terms of people's behaviors and their love and trust of the product itself?
So part of it, I would say a good part is derived from that, but a good part is derived not from that, just from the fact that I think digital connected fitness is inevitable. And so we're not having to like guess who it's like literally it's Apple sitting right in front of Peloton is the Apple of digital fitness. Like they're there. We all know it, right? Like, so if you just believe that digital connected fitness is a thing that's going to get huge over the next couple decades, maybe not over the next couple of years, but over the next couple decades, then it's, to me, it's so innately obvious that Peloton is like right up there with maybe Google or Apple, whatever, but they're going to be there, right? But a big part of it is understanding culturally. And again, this is where Wall Street fails. They don't take the time to understand the context of that. I'll call it the depth of passion. The depth of passion does not read well in data. Like, one of my favorite trades was Netflix when Stranger Things came out, because I actually had data that was on ticker tags that was able to measure the depth of interest in Stranger Things was stronger by a factor of 3 than any show in the company's history, because I monitored the mention frequency of people speaking about it in the 60 days after it was released. And what that meant was that people were more likely to like insist that their friends and their families and their coworkers must watch this show. And if to do it, they might have to subscribe to Netflix. Wall Street doesn't understand that type of subtlety in terms of debt. So what Wall Street, the data they were looking at that quarter was a company, I forget the name of the company, but they basically were the equivalent of Nielsen ratings for Netflix. All they showed was how many people watched a show. But where the information gets lost there is that if you look at every top Netflix show, roughly the same amount of people are watching the top 10 shows throughout the history of Netflix. So like, you're not able to understand the depth of passion because, yeah, everybody knew it was a top show, but there was other top shows like Orange is the New Black and other ones, right? I saw the depth of interest, and that was reading through the noise, and nobody else saw that. It was one of my biggest trades ever. So same thing with Peloton. If you see the way people are emotionally engaged to the experience, the community, the way it makes them feel about themselves, the club aspect of it, the in-the-know aspect of it, there's something there that's so special and meaningful that it truly is similar in a way to Tesla, by the way. It's a life-changing experience for a lot of people. It's an empowering experience. Sure. It's an experience that connects them to other people, okay? Instructors and other people. So many people are in their house alone in this world, okay? The Peloton experience connects you to people in a way that very few other things can in your home. And again, these are some of the subtle things that Wall Street doesn't really fully understand about. And that's why I'm in Peloton.
Yeah. I mean, it's it's impressive. Like I've been part of some Facebook groups and occasionally the question of Peloton comes up, and it's amazing to see the connection people have, the loyalty and the love of their Pelotons. And then like I've been following the, you know, Pelotons for a while, where it's like they're barely any on the used market at a discount. You know, it's like they just get like close to full price, and it's just it's quite remarkable, actually. I think
and
what you're talking about in terms of depth of passion, it's like there's something about that like I kind of like take a step back. I say, okay, you know, in the bigger picture, you've got a quantitative side, but you also got a qualitative side to things. There's always a yin and yang, you know, left and right, et cetera. And, you know, at times it seems like Wall Street and the quants have taken things to an extreme. You know, everything has to be quantifiable, you know, or quantitative. Whereas a lot of things, especially some of the biggest things, like the qualitative matters and sometimes precedes even the quantitative. Like for example, with Peloton, it really matters how deeply passionate people are about their Pelotons, whether it's like, you know, 11 out of 10 or 5 out of 10. Like that's going to mean a ton for the future of Peloton. But Wall Street or quants can't, you know, figure that's not in their models. They haven't found figured a way how to model that type of, you know, attachment. And it seems like, and this is like something I did early on with Tesla, is I interviewed probably at least 50 to 100 early owners the first few months that the Tesla Model S came out. And I asked them, what was your previous car? Why did you get the Tesla Model S? How's your experience with it? Would you trade, everything to get exactly what you're talking about, their depth of passion for this product compared to their previous car, which would be a BMW or Mercedes or something, you know, and see the difference. I want to see if there is like not a big difference of passion, then it's like a so-so company, you know. But if we're talking about a huge gap where people are like, I'm never going back to my old Mercedes S-Class or my BMW 5 Series, whatever, right? Because it sucks compared to this Tesla, then you've got potentially something. But that's something Wall Street is not going to catch, you know? That's like completely foreign language, you know? But it could be one of the most important things about a product or a company and, you know, indicating its future. But it's fascinating stuff. And it's what's more fascinating is a lot of this stuff isn't talked about, you know, in terms of investing. It's like,
this conversation that we're having right now is so offbeat for anything that you would see on any financial YouTube channel. And I love it. I love this interview. And honestly, like I so much of what we see in investing channels it's the same old stuff. And like, but I love it because that's what gives me an advantage, right? Like, I love it that the whole world is still consumed. I see these young kids that talk about this and technicals and this. I'm like, I get it. Like, if you're into it, awesome. But just know something, like, you have to do what other people aren't doing. You have to find opportunities where other people aren't. And like, because no one's thinking like this, that's the opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's one of the questions I wanted to ask you regarding the pros and cons of having a YouTube channel yourself, having a Dumb Money community Discord channel. I mean, part of it is like, hey, you could share the data, right? You could collaborate in terms of research, more boots on the ground. But then it does seem like there's a con where it seems like there will be people just following the trade because, you know, someone told them.
I love that question. But so I personally get 10 times more out of my community than I lose by having people, you know, trade what I trade. I mean, 70% of my trades are sourced from my community now, which is insane. Like, I can't even believe I'm saying that. Like, it's nuts that it's in such a young community that I'm sourcing more out of the community than I source for myself from my own trade research. So I get a ton out of the community, but it's also collaborative. Like, you have to have a community to have these conversations with. Like, but I never had people to have the conversations with. Like, nobody understood what I did. I could never have people to be like, how about this? Have you thought about this? Like, now I have thousands and tens of thousands of people that are bought into Social Arb that do everything that I do, and we poke holes in thesis and we collaborate and we share, and it's really an amazing, it's an amazing experience. It really is. And honestly, there's more to gain than there is to lose. But remember this, like, my personal objective, yes, I do want to grow a $1 billion foundation. So I still need to figure out how to get an edge over the rest of the trading world, not my community, but the world. But more than anything, I want to bring investors. I want to bring people into the investor class. Mm-hmm. Like, so like the only way to do that is through YouTube, TikTok, Twitter, all this stuff.
With more of a media presence, do you feel at all more self-conscious, more kind of like, oh, I'm making this trade, but then like, you have to share it, you know, with your community and your channel, and also when you get out, and it's an extra variable, you know. For example, before any media, before anything, you're just heads down yourself. You're going to the shopping market, you're going to the store, you're talking to people, you're sitting down with the numbers, with how much you want to invest. You know when to get out. You don't have the distraction of having to, you know, have all these people saying, "What's your next trade?" or "When are you getting out?" Right. I mean, this extra variable, like, I understand it's helpful for you and you're getting more trade ideas, but like, honestly, does it add more complexity? Does it add more,
I had a hedge fund for 60 days called Social Information Arbitrage, or SIA Capital. That was the worst experience in my life. The pressure of investing other people's money. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I had to close it down because I launched it at the same time as my tech company, TickerTags. And my clients for TickerTags wouldn't allow me to have a hedge fund and sell them data because they thought I was going to front run the data for my fund. Mm-hmm. So I was so thankful I got to close that fund down. That's a pressure that I could not handle. That really did make it difficult for me to trade because I was like, oh, I have to document stuff. Like, I'm second guessing myself. The community is so tight that I have that, like, they know I screw up. They've seen me screw up. When they see something they disagree with, they call me out on it. And I love it because, like, I'm like, hey guys, here's what I'm doing. Here's why I'm doing it. Every episode, I'm like, poke holes in my thesis. Let's go talk about it on Discord. Tell me what I'm missing. Like, and they have saved me out of getting out of trades because they show me things that I miss, which is just so ridiculously cool. So like, I'm very like, I am so transparent and chill with my like community that we just have an awesome relationship. Like, it's just I think it's a very unusual community. It really is like truly collaborative, and we just put it all out there. And like, by the way, my two partners on Dumb Money, Dave and Jordan, they don't think like me exactly. So every show is basically a fight. Like, it's like, Dave is kind of in the middle. Jordan is so ridiculously conservative. It destroys me that Jordan has been with me every day for the past 10 years. And like, he still doesn't see a lot of the light of what I do. And like, but I get it. He comes from a different place, a different mindset, a different objective. But even every once in a while, he's like, Chris, I can't believe I didn't do that thing that you did. I was right there. I'm like, that's cool, man. Let's just keep talking. I love that we're all so different. My community is different. It's a club, man. It's just like a club. We're all in it together. We win together. We lose together. We don't always all do the same thing.
Got it. Okay, so I've been dying to ask you this one question about amounts. So as your account has grown, and like I've noticed this myself, like, you know, at a certain point, the percent is small. It could be small, but the amount just seems like it could be very large. Like, for example, it's a small percent, but it could be like seven figures or something, you know? And so it's like, I personally get confused. I'm like, hey, is this a small investment or a big investment? Because it's like, it's a small percent, but it's like a big amount objectively. And I guess what I want to ask is like, you know, it seems like you're doubling down on risk taking. You're doubling down on trying to grow your portfolio, your funds, et cetera. You're not slowing down. Most people at a certain point would do the opposite. They would say, hey, I need to preserve my wealth more, you know, make different, you know, index funds, like, you know, real estate, et cetera, just like, you know, 5% for gambling, right? But in your case, you're like, kind of like, I'm sure you have some other stuff that's, you know, probably for your family, et cetera, but you know, you have an ambition that it seems like you're wanting to grow in an exponential, like multiply, right, what you have. When, as it grows, the stakes seem to get higher, like in terms of absolute amounts. How do you process that? Like what makes you like actually continue to go on?
Great question. I think it helps that I've been mentally preparing for this my whole life. And something that I've been asking myself for a very long time is how much is enough? Like how much is enough for me and my family, right? And like, we finally hit a point in the last couple of years that we hit a point that it was enough for us, right? So like, I no longer do anything for myself. I do not want a private jet. I do not want a yacht. I do not want any of that stuff. I don't want a Ferrari. I don't want a Lambo. Like I could have 100 Lambos. I don't want any of them. Like I drive my car for 7 years. I had a car detailing business as a kid. I drove all kinds of exotic cars. I'm like, I just burn out on them. It doesn't bring me personally joy in life. So I'm in a great position where I just love spending time with my family, and I love doing big things, like, and big ambitious things to try to change the world. But I don't have the stress of, oh my gosh, what if I lose 5 million and then I lose like this clout because I'm not as rich as I was. Like, that money is not mine anymore. So everything that I do now, if I make money in my personal account, I'm not planning on actually selling the stock after a certain point. I'm just going to take that stock and transfer it into the foundation, right? And so like my personal account, no matter how big it gets, it doesn't get any bigger because it's just transferring over. So I don't have the pressure or the stress to like, because I've already hit enough for me. And so there's nothing about me in my future of trading. So I think that helps a lot because I know other people where it's never enough. It's never enough, right?
Have you somehow de-risked in some way? Like, have you paid off your house? Have you put some type of inheritance fund for your kids? Have you done something to like kind of say, okay, this money is untouchable for my family, et cetera, and the rest
is... No, I love having a big mortgage because I've been generating 70%+ annualized returns for 15 years. So I'm going to take all the 3.5% money the world is willing to give me. All right. So like, I'm going to have a nice big mortgage. I'm not concerned about my mortgage. It's, you know, reasonably sized. I still get car loans because I like that for my credit. Listen, I like going on nice vacations and eating at nice places, but we don't buy designer clothes that much in our house. We don't like do that stuff. Like, we're not fancy, you know. I'm just not, I don't, like I said, I have a Yukon that's like 7.5 years old right now. And before that I had a Yukon that was 7 years old before I traded it in. We live a comfortable lifestyle, but listen, when you have a certain amount of money, like, how does it all go away? Like, I'm not foreseeing a situation where it like the stock market goes to zero. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. I'm not concerned about the market going to zero, getting zeroed out tomorrow. And if it does get zeroed out tomorrow, we kind of have bigger problems probably in the world. and the fact that the Dow just hit zero, right? Like that's not going to happen. So listen, the bottom line is I will kind of hedge myself on the way down. I'm okay losing 70% of my net worth, right? I'm prepared to lose 60 to 70% of my net worth. It would not destroy me. I could still live a nice life and, be okay. Mm-hmm.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, if I get a chance to talk with you again, which I'd love to, I mean, I would love to get into more of that psychological attachment or detachment to money. You know what I'm saying? Like there is this thing of I've always wondered, like, the whole thing of, I think sometimes when you're too attached to money, like, it means too much, like, it kind of can disservice you. It can make you so risk averse that you kind of can't really latch on to the big opportunities, you know, as if you were more detached or, let's say, more objective, you know, with money. I would love to learn your history.
In short, can I say this? Yeah. Like, the trick is bucketing money. Mm-hmm. And I did write that book in 2010, was called Laughing at Wall Street. That was my book. But honestly, Jack Schwager's Unknown Market Wizards, the chapter he did on me that came out last year, is better than my entire book. So, like, if someone's going to read about my background, I'd say, like, read Jack's book rather than reading my book. But in my book, I talk a lot about bucketing money and having what I call a big money account. Everybody needs to have a big money account. And the big money account, not financial advice, but, like, this is what I do, is money you're willing to take big risks with. And I call it other people's money. So it's like, okay, maybe you get your lawn mowed every week, get it mowed every 2 weeks, or get your hair cut every 5 weeks versus every 4 weeks, or clip coupons. You might not care about clipping $1 coupons, but if every dollar is $100 in future value, then you're going to cut dollar coupons. So that's behavior change. Like, wait an extra 6 months to get the new TV. And I bet that TV that you're ready to buy right now for $1,500 in 6 months will be $1,200. Same TV. You waited 6 months. You saved $300. That money's not coming to you. The $300 is going to the big money account. That's money you wouldn't have had, that you're not having to take out of vacations or college savings. You made a sacrifice in life to save some extra money so that it can go into this account that's going to make you financially wealthy and free at some point in your life sooner, because you're going to take big risk like a big money person does, right? That you normally don't, but now you will, because that money is separate. It's separate, okay? So, like, if there was one piece of advice that I've learned from, that has been it: to bucket my money, to have risk money, and to have money that's, safe money.
Yeah. Last question. Do you have any crypto investments at all?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I would say, and this has been a struggle for me, I have been studying crypto for 5 years. There's people very close to me. Their whole world is crypto, and they've been in my ear for 5-6 years. I still have more questions than answers. If I had one thesis on crypto, and I had an episode about this recently, my one long thesis on crypto is that at some point the crypto market becomes too big to fail. Whether we believe in it or not, whether we think it should even be a thing or not, doesn't matter to me. At some point it becomes too big to fail. It's not there today, but I don't think it's 10 years away. I think it's years away from being too big to fail. And I want to be investing in it along that journey, because if and when it becomes too big to fail, that is the type of game-changing thing that maybe only happens once in my lifetime, to something like a currency model. And you don't even need to fully understand it or appreciate it to appreciate the concept of too big to fail, and what then happens at that point in time in terms of governments and institutions regulating, pouring money into it. It's a whole different world. So I have most of my money tied up in Ethereum and then some in Bitcoin. And I dabble a little bit here and there with NFTs and stuff. But what I like most about Ethereum, and I look at this from a completely different perspective from people that are all in this world, because I don't believe in spending a lot of time in the crypto world in terms of my intellectual capacity. I don't want to waste my time in that world. But it's just bandwidth It's talent. The amount of talent suck that the Ethereum network has been bringing into it for the past 12 to 18 months, resources, people power, mind power, dedication, when they have pulled so much into that Ethereum world that they're starting to de-risk it in terms of it, not in terms of making sure that it's going to be around in 5 years, right? 10 years. So that's kind of my favorite thing about Ethereum is just the minds and the intellectual capital that is being kind of absorbed into that whole network is the reason why I have more Ethereum than anything else.
What's like the percent size of your total crypto holdings compared to the rest of your portfolio?
Yes, great question. It's about 3% of my total portfolio. At one point, it was 7%. I think I would like for it to be around 5%. It's not at 5% right now, but I'm very comfortable with it being 5% of my portfolio.
Yeah. Awesome. Chris, it's been a fantastic chatting with you. Yeah, learned a lot. I'm sure all the people listening also have been fortunate to be exposed to different thinking like this. Super helpful. How can people find you? I know you've got a website, dumbmoney.tv. You have a YouTube channel.
That has everything on it.
Okay,
literally,
YouTube channel.
Dumbmoney has all the socials.
Okay.
But like, obviously, I'm on Twitter at Chris Camillo. But dumbmoney.tv has both my live account on YouTube, where we talk about investing in the market, and it also has the old, we call it the OG Dumb Money channel, where we talk about investing in private companies, and we're about to restart that channel soon. So that's the other half of my life, which is investing in early stage. I invest in a lot of creator-founded companies now, content creator-founded companies. Mm-hmm. I'm working on some huge game-changing projects that I'll be announcing in the next few months that are creators that are founding companies in early stage venture. And I think that is a huge trend that will only get bigger the next decade. So half my world is connecting change to investable opportunities in the stock market. Mm-hmm. The other is connecting change to investable opportunities in the private market and the early stage market. But we have two channels for that.
Got it. Awesome, man. Yeah, love the conversation. Hope to do it again sometime in the future. And I wish you all the best.
You too. Thank you
all
so
right.
much.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
A lot of fun.